All right, folks, welcome to another edition of the Hollow Nine Spotlight, the Hollow Nine Network's interview show where we collect cool stories. And I know that sometimes we think that's just going to be like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger stopped by, but I got to tell you guys, tonight, this show really excites me. A couple years ago, I was in my apartment, chilling out on a Saturday, flipping around, and I caught the 7-5. A documentary that definitely watches more like a movie than a documentary, and probably one of the coolest stories, and even crazier. I'm from the area. It feels like it happened right near where I'm from, so maybe I felt a little bit of a sort of familiarity with it there. And thanks to the advent of modern technology, I've actually been able to get in touch with one of the subjects of that documentary, as well as the author who helped co-author the, Ken, would you call it a semi-autobiographical novel? What would you guys characterize this book as before I introduce you?
I guess you would say it's a memoir, because I wrote the book years before the documentary came out. So I guess it's a memoir, and then I passed it along to Frank and his partner Burl, and we put it all together into a book. True crime novel.
Yeah. It's guys, this is some awesome stuff. So to start, former police officer from the New York Police Department, where he served most notably in the 75th Precinct in Brooklyn, where life took on an adventure that most of us reserve for the likes of a Scorsese film, only for Ken, it was real. And joining us tonight to tell us all about not only life, but the book Betrayal in Blue that sort of documents it, please welcome Ken Ural to the show. Thank you for joining us, man.
Happy to be here.
Also joining us is Frank Girardot. Is that correct on the pronunciation? I should have asked you that before we started, too. I'm not doing great with this tonight. I'm going to admit it up front.
When you didn't ask me and we were leading up to it, I'm thinking, oh, man, what's going to happen here? Nice job. Perfect.
Sweet. All right. Now I feel good. This is just going to be awesome from here on out. Most known for the book Name Dropper, but also the CEO of Pegasus Communications and the co-author of Betrayal in Blue. Frank Girardot, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. And of course, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Ken. So, hey, Ken.
What's up, Frank?
I'll tell you what. One of the coolest things that happened was I tweeted out one night, I can't suggest enough the documentary The 7-5. And I don't usually check my tweets to see like who responds or who likes them. I just like throw stuff out into the ether and then just like move on. Because over at the Hollow Nine Network, we have a lot of programming going on. I'm kind of curating a lot. But one of the notifications I got was that it was liked by Ken Ural, and I was like, no shit, the guy from the fucking thing? I was like, okay, this is really cool. And that's what kind of started opening the lines of communication here. And I'm saying all this to say that, you know, after asking if he'd be interested in doing the interview, he was like, you know, send me the link to your website so I can check you out. Now, that's normal, you know, for people like me. But after reading the book, I was like, I just got vetted by Ken Ural, and I passed the test because he's here for the show. So that was pretty cool, I got to say. It's sort of like a meta element to the show tonight.
Yeah, I sort of have a notification set on all my social media for anybody that mentions the 7-5. So I'll read them what they say, and you know, I'll leave a like if I like it. Sometimes I respond with a reply. And people seem to get a little freaked out sometimes, you know.
Well, you know, it's like
it's strange because we're just myself and the other subjects in the documentary. We're regular people, but at times people, because I guess we're on, you know, Netflix now, and we were on Showtime in the past, and it was in the theaters for a brief time. People see us as like we're actors almost. It's very strange. But, you know, it takes getting used to.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah, they didn't prep you for this. Like, there was no course to be like, no, by the way, after we do this documentary, people might start, you know, recognizing you places.
Exactly.
anything, I know you were telling me yesterday when we were kind of checking in, there was some sort of funny stories that happen as a result of that sometimes. that come along with this sort of fame now that you're enjoying. You want to tell everybody that story real quick?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's more disturbing. This past one is more disturbing than funny. I mean, we go out to a restaurant or a bar or even, shopping. People will come up and recognize me. They say hello or do I know you from somewhere, that type of thing. But this past Sunday, Sunday morning, we're sitting down eating breakfast. My dog is barking, so I look out the front window. And I see a car just passing my house real slow, and he stops and he starts backing up, and then he just stops in front of my driveway, and he's looking at one of the cars I have in the driveway, and he's looking down, looking at the car, looking down, and then it looks like he's writing something. So I'm like, I'm not gonna just let somebody sit in front of my house and not find out what's going on.
Right,
plus I got
right.
security cameras all over the house, so it's all on video. And I go outside and I go right up to the window and I bang on his window and it's like, can I help you? And he almost jumped out of his skin. I scared the shit out of him because he was looking down. And I guess he realized it was me, and the window slowly came down, a power window, and he reached in the back, and I'm like cranking my head to see what he's going for.
Yeah, he's making a lot of mistakes here. These are not the right moves to do.
Sick people, he's already a little screw loose, I'm thinking, just coming up to someone's house. I mean, like yourself, this social media, you could contact anyone nowadays.
Right.
So he's reaching in the back and he pulls out a NYPD shield. And this guy is got 10, 15 years on me. So he's in his late 60s, early 70s. So it's obviously he's retired and it's a duplicate shield because you got to hand in your original shield. I'm like, dude, you should know better than just come to my house. What can I do for you? And then he has a whole manuscript he wrote, like sort of like what I did, story on his life. And he's been trying to get it published. And he looked me up. He saw an article in the Tampa Bay Times. And he looked me up. He found out where I lived. And just decided to show up at my house one Sunday morning. I was like, don't you know better than that?
Yeah. I mean, so, he has all these other ways he could have reached out. You know, he could have found you on Twitter like I did, So I gotta tell you, I'm glad I passed the test, man. Thank you for at least seeing something cool enough to say, yeah, I'll jump on that show. And Frank, what made you agree to do this? And, tell me a little bit also about how you guys wound up getting hooked up together to write the book version.
I was reaching out to, publishing companies and authors on and off prior to the documentary coming out. And then once the documentary came out, I sort of had a renewed interest and I got a little more aggressive with it. And I had contacted one author who recommended I talk to the guy who wrote the article for the Tampa Bay Times. It was Paul Guzzo. Mm-hmm. And I talked to him about, because he did an article on me, maybe you would be interested in doing a book with me. And he thought it was beyond his scope of journalism. So he knew Burl and Frank, I guess, from a past experience with another book. And he gave me their contact information, and I got in contact with Frank and Burl and sent them my manuscript, and they seemed very happy with it. Frank, you can pick it up if you want.
I mean, when I first read, when I read what Ken wrote, I was exactly thinking like Scorsese, Goodfellas type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it was so naturally dramatic and had all these great, storylines in it and the characters well before ever, I didn't watch the documentary until we were well into the writing of the book. And, the manuscript itself was a home run, really.
Yeah.
Out of the blue. And so I talked to Burl Bear. We've written a couple of books together. And I said, hey, listen, Burl, we got to do this. He agreed. And so we did. And then what we decided, though, we had to make a conscious choice. And you'll see it when you read the book. We couldn't just write about the 7-5 because you've already got the documentary out there. Mm-hmm. And there was a book, a really crappy one that was written in the 90s. Kind of about the case, so we couldn't just do the journalism part of it either. So we had to kind of take Ken's story and the documentary style of that, and pair it with something fresh. And what the first thing that we found out was that Ken's story, in the story of the guys in the 7-5, Ken and Mike and Adam Diaz, this stuff didn't just happen in a vacuum. The New York Police Department has a pattern of corrupt officers, you know, working neighborhoods, going all the way back to the, you know, before the Civil War. So, this would really be interesting. You know, we can kind of like, you know, build up this history of the New York Police Department and show how these, you know, how these wheels are in place. And one of the things, you know, the reason, if you look at our book, Betrayal in Blue, it's in blue. And it's because there's this blue wall, and that's really what the book is about, the blue wall. Yeah. As I see, you know, that allows corruption, because it is corruption, to exist, and on a large scale. And in fact, I mean, you know, there were times when Ken was still on the force that his bosses had a pretty good idea of what was going on, but didn't really, you know, do anything about it because they were worried about how it would reflect on the larger police department's image.
Yeah. Now, I mean, especially I would say, you know, there's something that's really almost eerie about the timing that this book is coming out and sort of the current atmosphere around things like truth and digging up the past and people sort of maybe sometimes just deciding they don't want to believe, even though there's evidence being presented to them. Was there an atmosphere even remotely like that? Ken, maybe you want to take this, at the time that you were on the force, where it was sort of like the public kind of knew, but everyone just sort of looked the other way because it was better to just believe what we were supposed to. The police are the good guys, all the drug dealers, and basically anyone who wasn't white at that time, I think it was pretty blatant that's what they were doing, were the bad guys, and that's how we're just going to leave it. You know, why do you think it was able to operate that way?
Well, basically, like Frank said, the higher-ups and, you know, this city itself, New York City, they don't want to expose the bad light because it reflects back on them. And the bosses, you know, they take the fall for anything that their subordinates do. So if they find something, it's pushed to the side, pushed to the side, pushed to the back burner. They don't want to, regardless, it keeps coming out. Like Frank said, it was basically 20-year cycles. Before us, you had Serpico, and there's been series of corruption scandals after us. It's never going to stop.
Yeah.
But it seems to be, you know, like they want to be vigilant. Now with social media, they get on top of it. We're exposing it. But it's, you know, they don't expose it until it's exposed, and then they say, oh yeah, we knew all about it.
Right.
It's the corruption's there. They may know about it, and they'll just, you know, hey guys, lay low, you know, knock this off. Or they just start taking notes on it, and they used to have this thing called the tickler file. If they knew about corruption, they would take the things about myself and Dowd and Chicky, and they just put it in a file and set it to the side. Okay, we know about it. And they had the IAD investigators checking up on us, but they would give them no support and things like that. So you know, and the public, like New York, the people that were a longtime New York residents going back then, they knew about the corruption. They prior to us, it wasn't as established as we got into, but there was always corruption. They had the pad before us. The whole department was getting paid off.
Huh. So. Wow. So yeah, I mean, I guess that's sort of one of the things that, you know, I was left with after reading the book and even too after watching the documentary was, you know, are there actually good cops? Like, not meaning good the way it was described in the documentary, but like, are there the cops who are, you know, upholding the law? And
absolutely.
And what is it like for them to be coexisting with all this going on so openly? Like, can you talk about that a little bit? And Frank, anything you found in your notes or in your research that you want to throw in, by all means, please jump in as well.
Let me tell you, when you're a good cop in the real sense of the word being good, and you know about corruption, like if something happens right in front of you, you don't say nothing because you suddenly ostracize. If people think you're going to be and telling on them or the word everyone likes to use is rat or snitch. If you're going to rat them out or snitch them out, you are ostracized. Nobody wants to be anywhere around you, and you become the subject of very, very, I don't want to say jokes because they're really not jokes. I mean, they'll have dead rats on your car. You'll go out to your car and you'll have four flat tires. You'll repair your tires. They're flat again the next day.
So this is like real movie stuff, like stuff from the movies and TV, full on happening.
That's real life. I mean, there was a time they suspected one of the guys in our precinct of working for internal affairs. They used to call them field associates. And your locker, your uniforms hang up from left to right. So they turned his locker sideways and shot a gun through the side of the locker. So it went through every single one of his uniforms.
Wow.
It ruined all his uniforms.
Yeah. But so, also, I mean, that's also a threat too, though, right? That's like a, hey, you know.
That's exactly what it is. It's exactly what it is. A threat. They're telling you not to do that.
Jeez.
And it gets even worse when you're in the street and God forbid you need somebody's help. They're not coming to help you.
Yeah.
They'll, you know, suddenly, you know, get a flat tie themselves. They'll go real slow. Oh, we picked up another job. We can't come help him. Or they'll get there and they'll delay their response time to get to help them. And by then it's too late.
And that's what happened to Serpico. And
That's exactly what happened to Serpico.
You know, that's the problem with being a rat. But I think, and when Ken talks about good cops, by the way, he's speaking from experience. Because for, you know, the majority of Ken's career as a police officer, he was a good cop. Mm. You know, yeah, he might have slept on the midnight shift or, you know, gone out and had a couple of drinks in the patrol car. But, you know, Ken wasn't taking money from drug dealers. He wasn't protecting dealers. He wasn't doing runs with Mike and the boys. You know, Ken was 9-to-5 guy that played on the softball team and, you know, was working his way through a career in the police department. What's interesting about everything that Ken just said and what happened to him is precisely that point in time when you have a choice, right? And in Ken, and in this book and in the documentary, that point in time comes when he's paired with Mike Dowd.
Hmm.
And Mike takes some money from a crime scene and, you know, being the generous partner that he was, gave some of it to Ken. And you can read how Ken, you know, felt about that and what he did, unless Ken wants to tell you how that, because that's the point where, you know, where Ken's got a choice and the choice are both bad. He can be a rat or he can be a bad guy.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically, you know, the career fork in a road for my career. They take some money, shoves it in my hand. And now I could either accept the money and now I've crossed the line, don't take the money. And now, you know, the word goes out. He's, you know, puts the word out among his friends that I must be a rat because I'm not accepting the dirty money. Or I could take the money and then never do nothing again, which is almost next to impossible. But then I'm considered just as dirty.
Right.
Well, I take the money and turn them in, and then I really am, you know, threatening my own life and career. So,
yeah, so I mean, like, when you look at it, like,
really
that,
a no-win situation.
Yeah, I mean, this is much more, it becomes a moment where you decide, do I want to survive or not?
Exactly.
There aren't a lot of career fields out there where those kind of stakes come into play. You know, I mean, like, if I have a bad day at the office, like, all right, I just don't talk to one of my co-producers or something for a couple days. But it's not like no one's shooting through uniforms and no one's leaving you out to dry when you need them to save your life. But then there's also nobody sort of watching for those signs. Do you think that there are other people who are probably sort of trapped in the same situation you were, who are trying to figure out a way to get out of it before it gets to the sort of levels that some of your adventures get to? And is there anything they can do to maybe navigate that, you think?
Hey, wait, let me jump in before Ken answers that.
Okay.
Because there's a flip side to this. Like, we're thinking, oh, everybody's good and they just face this fork in the road. And that's not the case. I mean, there are guys, legit guys on the police force, especially in Ken's era, who are bad guys. And they're there because they're bad guys and they're doing bad things. Right, Ken?
Oh, yeah. There's absolutely guys who started out from day one, even before they were cops. They were criminals and just happened to make it through all the tests and everything and they became a cop strictly to be a criminal.
Wow.
And then there are – so – but on the flip side of the coin, there are guys 100% always wanted to be a cop. The, you know, whole family, all their family were cops, and they thought of nothing but being a cop. And they, you know, great cops. They go through the whole thing, and also it could be they never come to that fork in the road. Not everybody comes to that fork in the road. It took me 7 years till that fork reached me, until I hooked up with that one partner. Right. I mean. I've seen corruption before that, but it was never thrust right into my hand. Right. And I ignored it. I never, you know, it was never something I was going to do. I was the typical cop that, okay, I'm ignoring it. And that's their thing. That's what they do. So.
Wow. So, I mean, it's, I guess one of the things that I always think of, especially even when you're watching movies where, you know, it's all like fictitious, the sort of moment after the storm, you know, I know we're kind of jumping around the timeline here, but when you finally got clear of everything you got pulled into, what is day one of the new life like? You know, how do you talk to your family about it? How do you sort of begin to, you know, accept it and move on?
Well, my family was pretty much surprised as much as, you know, I was. It was, you know, hit the papers the next day. I was arrested one night and it hit the papers the next day. So I didn't really have the chance to break it to anyone.
Hmm.
It was just thrown out there for them. So, you know, I didn't never really, to be honest, sat down with my parents and say, okay, this is what I did. It was already out there what I did.
Yeah,
it didn't need to be explained to them. So I think my father sort of had an inkling. I go into this a little in the book that I was doing things. You know, I went from a really basic life to living a higher lifestyle. You know, I sold a little Cape Cod house, and then all of a sudden I'm building a big brand new custom ranch. I have, you know, two Corvettes. I have a Lincoln. My wife has a car. We're doing vacations. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know, and he sort of doesn't come right out and tell me, but he goes, you know, my boss's son had a Corvette, brand new Corvette, and it got confiscated by the police because he was, you know, he was driving around with drugs in his car. So he's sort of like,
it was almost like a
trying
TV
to tell
dad.
Me, I know what you're doing. Be careful or stop. Without coming right out and saying it.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like in Blow when, you know, when Johnny Depp's dad is over and he's like, all right, you're doing pretty well for yourself. I'm going to say I don't know what you're doing, but
exactly.
As long as you're being careful.
Yeah.
Do you think, you know, well, maybe one of the cool things is that we could put out there the side of it where there's maybe a survival aspect that probably still doesn't seem to come to the surface, at least I don't think that's readily apparent, though, at least the way you put it a little while ago, you know, that there are so many other possible ramifications of every aspect of this. You know, if I take the money and I don't do anything, it still sends signals. And if people don't see that, because that's not a situation that comes up for a lot of people out there, I don't think. Maybe it does, maybe not in the same way, but maybe not to this level of intensity. But even like, I would say like now, you know, like if one of your kids told you they were thinking about becoming a police officer, would what you've gone through, you know, would you have given them a different answer if you had stayed a cop who had stayed clear of all this versus having all this in your history? You know what I mean?
Even if I was clean cop throughout my entire career, I would have never told my son to become a cop. It was never for me the dream job. Like I always wanted to be a cop. I became a cop, and I say it in the movie, basically because I had no direction in life. And back in the 70s, there was a paper. It was called The Chief in the Northeast. It always put out weekly all the civil service exams, mailman, fireman, sanitation man, police officer, that came out in the area. And my mother would pick it up weekly because I really wasn't doing nothing. I was working in an electronics factory doing a basic schematic wiring. And she would go, you know, hey, take a look at this job. Take a look at this job. Maybe you'll do this. Because the job to have in New York was a city job because it was a 20-year retirement, was unlimited sick days, and you know, you get a pension. My father had to work 60 years till he got a pension.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you know, they pushed me in the other direction. My father was a construction worker. His whole life, broke his back, and it took him 60 years to get a pension. And if he didn't get unlimited sick days, if he didn't work, he didn't get paid.
Yeah. Yeah. There were a lot of jobs like that.
In an area. So, yeah, to answer your question, I would have never directed my son to do that because it's a dangerous job. It's unforgiving. And right now there's no respect for being a cop. People constantly, go against your authority.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, if we were just in the schoolyard playing softball and the lights, it got dark, it got at dusk, the cops would come around and kick us out of the schoolyard. You never say, oh, no, we're playing ball. We could be here because it's a schoolyard. It's a public property. No, they kick you in the ass and send you home.
And, I mean, do you feel like there was a little bit more order to it back then? I mean, I guess that I was probably from somewhere in between where that generation ended and this next generation of, the entitlement and all that came in. But there does seem to be something that was a little bit more, I don't know, easy. I mean, definitely social media and the fact that there are cameras everywhere now, too. It's a totally different, world. It's a different environment.
Absolutely.
When you think about some of the things that you guys were doing, I know this is something we kind of mentioned yesterday, too. It would be near impossible to do some of these things now with the way technology is and, just your cell phone they'd be tracking you with, right?
You would think that. But read the papers every day. There's cops getting arrested. Let me tell you, since I was arrested, I've been doing research on police officers getting arrested. I must have stories on 500-600 different stories on officers that have been arrested, which is, Frank, I don't know if should you want to announce this.
Sure, let's announce it. That's good times any.
Yeah, we're actually in the middle of a second book.
I was going to say, is this an exclusive we're getting, a trailer for the sequel?
Frank and I
are doing a second book. It's tentative. We have a couple of titles floating around, but it's tentatively known as The Bad Cop Book.
Nice. Dude, this is super cool. I've got chills already just anticipating some of the stuff that's going to be in there. And one of the other things too, Frank, I love your style. The way you guys crafted this. I know you mentioned earlier that it was sort of documentary style, but I was describing it to a friend and I was saying it's almost like the way someone who is there would be telling you the story in person, where it's like every once in a while there are these time jumps, but it makes sense and it just flows. But I think there was a lot of structure from Ken's story being sort of the through line. How are you guys going to approach this next one? Is it going to be sort of the same style or is there going to be a sort of difference to the way this one appears to the reader?
So this is going to be more of a digest or an anthology. We're gathering up, harvesting from Ken's 600 bad cops and a few that I know. And then what we're going to do is we're going to do some straight reporting on this stuff, but then have Ken sort of react to it, based on his experience as a bad cop. Like, hey, this guy did this, this guy did that. The interesting thing is that, you want to make it, you want to think that, there's a couple ways to look at it. We're trying to narrow it down. You want to think that, it's all drug dealers and it's all murders and it's all that. But it's not. I mean, some of this stuff is funny, funny because it's so stupid. So we're trying to, put some humor in it too. But the other issue I think that Ken and I both have is that, we have friends who are cops and who are good cops, and heroes even. And, it's hard to be constantly the guy that, hey, I'm writing a new book about cops. Well, yeah, they all suck too. Sorry how that makes you.
Well, I mean, I guess there's unfortunately kind of an occupational hazard now with everything that's coming out. So,
it is. It really, you know, and these, a lot of these, the thing is, I mean, kidding aside, it's not just in New York, you know, and it is, and it's not just like, you know, drugs and drug money. There's, you know, there's brutality, there's, you know, there's corruption of a different sort, just straight up thievery from taxpayers. There's, you know, there's all sort, there's, you know, just stuff, sexual stuff where, you know, cops pull over women and rape them. And if you're, now you think about like Ken's dilemma, right? Well, you're this poor woman who's just been pulled over by a police officer who's got a badge and a gun and a nightstick. And, you know, he's going to let you go off, you know, some stupid DUI because if you give him a, you know, if you give him a Hummer. And, you know, I mean, these poor women that have been taken advantage of, it's you know, it's terrible. And these stories aren't often told. So we're trying to find the best, you know, couple dozen of these to roll up.
Wow.
And just to make it clear, 99% of the cops out there are honest. This is the 1% dark side that have crossed the line that we're talking about. Mm. Just because we're, you know, talking about this and writing a second book on it doesn't mean all cops are bad. We're talking about the 1%.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
The 1% that people want to read about.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Well, I mean, it's interesting that we also kind of got into this by talking about the title of the second book. When you think about the title of the first one, when it's called Betrayal in Blue, is there's a, that I feel like the betrayal could be going in a couple different ways. Do you see that it being a sort of ambiguous betrayal, or who do you guys see as the ones being betrayed? Is there someone who's being betrayed the most?
It works. The title works both ways. It's Betrayal in Blue because I betrayed the badge, and then just to spoiler alert, I betray my partner at the end. But, you know, the movie's been out for 3 years, so.
Right, as you say, the movie kind of be, and it still hits you hard. I mean, the things, the details that you go into in the book, definitely, too. I think there was one thing where you said you felt like that the movie portrayed this in a way that you didn't feel was true and you wanted to set the record straight, so the book was kind of.
There's a lot of time hops in the movie that just don't fill in properly.
Oh, yeah, I mean, this.
People will watch it and they'll think that I was arrested on my own, and then I went out like Henry Winter in the 7-7, got arrested. They gave him a wire, and he went back on patrol. That's not what happened to me.
Right.
Myself and the other cops were all arrested the same day. We were out on bail, and 3 months later, I flipped on my partner when he came up with a Butch Cassidy plan.
Yeah, which is, I mean, in the movie, you get a taste, I would say. In the book, you get. It was my, that it's really, guys, go on the adventure, go check it out. You can get it, I guess, on Amazon and all the other places. Where can people find this before we go any further? Let's let people, while they're listening at their computers, can open the Google machine and order themselves a copy.
Amazon is the easiest. Betrayal in Blue by Ken Urell, Frank, how do we say it? Giordoc. Very French. I've known you for 3 years. I didn't say it that well.
And my business partner, the guy that's in business with me, has never said it well. But you know, if you, okay, so it's a French last name, the T is silent, like Merlot or Brigitte Bardot.
Girardot.
There you go.
Yeah, guys.
Girardot. Yeah, Dave was all over that. I think you put that in a computer program and let it say back to you, and then you pronounce it.
I actually have a lot of French Canadian friends who are hopefully going to be listening to this, and I'm hoping I made them proud as well.
I hope so, being French Canadian. But yeah, Amazon's a good place. You can go to your local bookstore and order it. They carry it at my local bookstore here in Pasadena, California.
Also, you can go on probably all our social media. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Ken Urell, KenEurell, and I have links to go direct to buy the book.
We want you to buy it, you can reach out to either of us.
Give us feedback.
And Dave, I think you're right. I mean, it's a different look at the story. And you know, when you watch that documentary, you really, it's like one of those things that just stays with you. The characters, you know, it's not Ken and Mike. right? You know, Chicky is a powerful force in that documentary.
Oh yeah.
And so is Adam Diaz.
Adam Diaz, my God. Yeah, this is a slight plug for me to be begging him to come on the show next. Adam, if you're listening, I would love to chat with you. You should come on with Ken and Frank, because, damn, man, the distinction with all of you guys have very distinct voices, but one of the things that does also stand out the most is Ken, the way I'm going to say this probably come out a little awkward, but you're like the heart of it all. You know, that you're the one who was like the good person that kind of got pulled in. And I got the impression, which I think is what happened, is that it was almost like it got so far out of control before you even realized you needed to think about getting out. And it was scary how easily that could happen.
Like I said it a couple of times, it was like living outside my body, watching a movie, the things I was doing. It was crazy. No idea. You know, greed does take over. I have to say, and this doesn't just apply to cops. This applies to anybody. You tell people they find a wallet in the street filled with cash. They're not giving that wallet back with the cash. They're just throwing a wallet in, you know, either in the garbage can or a mailbox,
right?
If you can find a mailbox nowadays. But greed takes over. Greed, you know, you're offered so much money and you're making so little as a paycheck that you almost can't turn it away. It's so easy.
Yeah.
Once you're in it, you're in it. And this, like I say, there's no turning back. There's no becoming a cop again once you do it.
Yeah, I mean, and even now, you know, when you look back on it, or if you see something in a movie that even feels like it's similar to situations that you were in, do you have, like, flashbacks to it? Does it affect you at all?
Not so. Like now, I said it on a couple other interviews. I could be driving behind a Brinks truck, and the back breaks open, and all the cash comes flying out. I'm not taking it. I'm not going near it. And I think it happened recently where a bunch of people grabbed it all and they got in trouble for it.
Wow.
But I'm not doing that. I don't cross the line no more. I am done. I've learned my lesson. You know, 1990, and this is going back to the 80s and 90s. I was arrested in 92. So I've been on the straight and narrow ever since.
Wow. And I didn't mean to imply anything otherwise. I was just saying, you know, sometimes people who've been through things that they then see sort of trivialized on TV. I just feel like, you know, something like this, as much as watching the documentary wouldn't leave me as an audience member, the fact that these things are sort of part of your life, does it ever, you know, stop you in your tracks and you say, wow, man, I went through some crazy shit? Or is it something that's kind of completely behind you as much as it can be, even though you're being interviewed about it constantly and doing another book about it and all that stuff? You know, I mean...
People remind me every day I lived a crazy life. They contact me on social media all the time. You guys were fucking crazy. You guys were out of control. You know, and I say it probably runs about 60-40 in favor of, God, I wish I could have done that with you.
Well, I was going to say, you know, there is an element that I feel like does come out of the at least the documentary. I feel like the book, you feel your pain a lot more. I mean, you feel your pain in the documentary for sure. But
there's always the root for the bad guy to get away.
Yeah.
And since the beginning of the time, root for the bad guy.
But too, you know, I mean, the way you justified it in the documentary, for sure, hearing your voice saying it again while I was reading the book, the idea of, you know, people can say what they want. I saw it as not murdering somebody, or I saw it as stopping something like this from happening, which is, I mean, when you think about it, that's at the core of what you should have been doing as a cop. So it is kind of that movie moment where, like, the hero has that realization, you know? And
yeah, the light bulb over the head.
yeah. And I think the fact that it's about somebody who you read as super real, you know what I mean? And even just chatting with you, you know, but when we spoke yesterday to get Skype set up, it's like, wow, you know, the fact that this could happen to real people, that it isn't just this crazy thing that only happens in the movies. Do you hope that these books and the documentary are going to maybe affect police culture a little bit and maybe help to I know we said it's never going to go away, but maybe to help sort of scale some of this back or help it.
I mean, I would hope that, you know, a young rookie cop reads the book and says to himself, if he ever gets in that situation, I don't want to go through what he went through. Yeah, it was good for a while, but everyone goes down in the end. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. And stay on that straight and narrow. And we talked about before, I didn't really answer, you know, how should I handle it if I knew what I knew now? Back in that situation when I was tempted to cross the line and I crossed the line, what I should have done was contact, and I said it a couple of times, contact an outside agency or go to a defense attorney and set up any money I got, put in an escrow. And then when it all falls apart, look, I didn't spend none of this money. I was set up with a defense attorney and just handled it differently. But yeah. I was, you know, a young 26-year-old kid getting $8,000 a week in cash, plus all the side money we were making on top of that from different runs and scores. It was ridiculous. So,
yeah, it is. I mean, it's the attractiveness of that kind of money is even for someone who's not even going to have that kind of an opportunity. It definitely sticks with you when you watch that and when you read this. You're like, wow. You know, I mean, who wouldn't want to get out of credit card debt like tomorrow because they worked for 2 weeks? You know what I mean? Like, it would be near impossible to turn down.
I think the other part is, too, is that, you know, Adam Diaz is a charming guy.
Dude, you know, for real. For real.
You know, you know, you're not working for Scarface, right? You know, you're working for a guy who's got some charm, he's got some Milan, he moves in circles of, you know, high society, and he's got.
I said it in a book. I didn't see Adam as a drug dealer. I saw him as a businessman.
He's smooth, you know. Your idea of the drug dealer is a thug. Right. Adam is not a thug. So, you know, it becomes more believable that you can, you know, be swayed by somebody who's that charming and you know, and I'll tell you, interviewing him extensively for the book, it was a pleasure. I've interviewed lots of crooks and, you know, and psychopaths and sociopaths and every other kind of path you can think of. And you know, Adam could have been my next door neighbor.
Yeah, you know, wow.
Upfront, chatty, you know, willing to talk about every part of it. You know, like I say, charming. Charming is the best way to describe Mr. Diaz.
And I think you guys have a photo in the book of all of y'all at the premiere of the movie. Did Adam go to that as well? I mean, what's it like what is it like for you guys to, like, I guess for...
To be honest, I don't think he's allowed back in the country. I know he was deported back to... Yeah, wow. He was deported back to the Dominican Republic.
Wow. That's wild. What was it like for you to run into Mike at the premiere? I mean, do you guys stay in touch still?
No, social media tore us apart. I had seen Mike once before the premiere during the filming of the movie, and they threw it to the editing room floor because I guess they didn't like the way it came out. They took me back to Brooklyn and took me to my old precinct, the 7-5. And as I walked around the corner to the front of the precinct, he was standing out front, and I walked up to him and we looked at each other. We smiled and we gave each other a big hug. I think they were looking for some type of, you know, and I hadn't seen him in 20 years at that point.
So they were hoping you guys were going to throw down. Yeah,
They probably wanted some type of confrontation, but that didn't happen. So that didn't make the documentary. Wow.
That's unfortunate. That feels a little too reality TV for me anyway. I think that's the sort of thing that I feel like I want to tell people the most about why they should watch the documentary, why they should read this book, is because of how close this feels to everybody now, because you guys are real people. I mean, I at the same time, I do want them. I could see them making like a Hollywood movie of this, and one of the fun questions could be, you know, who do you think should play you and stuff like that. But the fact,
I don't know if you're aware, but Sony bought the rights, and they're making a Hollywood version.
Oh wow, nice! I think you've mentioned that they were talking to you guys about it, but. Well, that's more exclusive. Is that exclusive? You guys have probably told that other places, but I feel pretty good about saying it here. Well, for anyone who's listening to the Hollow Nine Network, you know, you're learning that we're going to get to see the Hollywood version, but go watch the documentary, read the book. And the only reason I would say watch the doc first is because that effect of being able to hear their real voices while you're reading the book, it was like a cool experience. There's only one other, I don't know, as far as like, you know, novel books that are not based in reality, fiction books, if you guys like. There was a recent show on Stars that was made out of Neil Gaiman's book, American Gods. And I read that last summer, and the only actor I knew who was in the show was Ian McShane. So when I was reading his character stuff, I heard his voice. But everybody else I got to picture myself and create my own versions of, which was nice. But for something like this, based on a true story, you know, it's cool to be able to hear, you know, your voice when the sections that are directly quoting you are in there. When you think about what you're, you know, it's interesting that you've landed in this sort of part of it where you're writing books, you're appearing on podcasts and doing interviews. It's kind of, you know, if you think about it, this silver lining of where you've landed, it kind of does put you in a great position to be able to, you know, help people if there are people who might feel like they need a hand either, you know, telling this kind of a story or getting out of this kind of a situation. Do you have a suggestion for anyone who feels like they're stuck in the situation you were in and like what they should do? I know you've kind of listed a few things you wish you had done, but what would you tell somebody who's listening to this and saying, shit, man, that's exactly where I'm at?
Absolutely. Go to a criminal defense attorney, lay it all on the line. They're your best friend. My guy set me straight. He was a great lawyer, and you know, he worked out the best possible thing for me. And that's what a criminal defense attorney is going to do. And it doesn't mean you're going to be exposed to the rest of the department and everything's going to come out. He'll just keep you in check and, you know, tell you your best step forward from that point. And hopefully you're not in too deep by the time you do that.
Yeah. Frank, from being around this but not being a police officer, has this changed the way you see police officers? Or do you ever feel like that these are all the people you can count on? Is there anything that this has made you think differently after working on this project in particular, or any of the ones about, you know, you said you've interviewed a lot of crazy and scary people. How do you sort of cope with coexisting with this?
That's a deep question. It hasn't changed my opinion of police officers. You know, most of my career has been a reporter, and specifically a cop reporter in Los Angeles, and during the same period of time that all this stuff was happening in New York. So, you know, I've seen it, you know, the same side of it, the Rodney King, but different, in a different way, you know, in a more brutal way. The LAPD has a reputation for brutality.
Yeah, the whole Rampart scandal and
The Rodney King stuff, you know, on and on and on. I mean, even reflected in the O.J. Simpson case, which I covered when it was a trial.
Oh, wow.
So I have, I would say that, you know, if you're around cops and looking from the outside in, you have a nuanced sort of view of, you know, what they do and who are the good cops and who are the bad cops. And I have family. My brother was a prosecutor for many years, and cousins who are in law enforcement. So, you know, it's kind of a family thing, like it is with Ken's, you know, family, where you got firefighters and police officers. It's just that, you know, what I learned in writing this with Ken, it was that these, and I said it at the onset of this, I've said it many times, is that these things don't happen in a vacuum. There's a culture in the department that, you know, breeds it and encourages it, even if they don't admit that they're encouraging it. And, you know, it could be because, for example, at that time, you know, wages weren't in line with where they should have been. There were constant threats of layoffs. And when you're raising a family on a police officer's salary in a place, by the way, you think about Brooklyn in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, and it is not the, you know, the gentrified Brooklyn of today. This is a war zone. This is a place where, you know, you're lucky as a cop to you know, go a shift without seeing a dead body.
Wow.
God's sake.
Yeah.
Right? Absolutely true.
I mean, it's so you know, it's the entire job is corrupting. It, you know, it's not even like what's in your soul. It's just what's there. The city at that time was terrible.
Yeah.
You become run down, and what cops call it, burnt out. You're just burnt out on the job. You it's like going through, say, somebody who was working in Manhattan, where, you know, on Fifth Avenue, where everything's nice. If you're working in Brooklyn at that time, it's 100 times the rate you're aging and learning the job, and everything is super fast progressed. And, you know, by the time you're 2-3 years on a job in Brooklyn, you're burnt out. Mm-hmm. You got to cycle guys through. You can't leave them there for their whole career. It's crazy.
Yeah. And also, you know, a lot of the friends I have who have either been firefighters or EMTs or police officers, there's just something about the constantly being exposed to the sort of worst side of the city and the society, and it's the people who are being violent to each other, and it is the drug dealers and the people who are just making that war zone, that war place that it's like, you know. I don't think people can't really.
People in the suburbs don't really realize how bad it was back then. I mean, Brooklyn at that time, especially Bed-Stuy and East New York where we were, it looked like post-World War II Germany. It was hard. You got dilapidated buildings, you know, half a building standing, another building right next to it totally knocked down. The whole lot was filled with bricks. It was horrible. You go into an apartment building where people are living, you're walking up a dilapidated stairway, you get to the top where the drug location was, and there's $300,000 in cash and 50 kilos of cocaine. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It's, you know, stuff that I've only seen in movies, but, you know, sometimes when you see the movies, you're like, can it really have been like that? And to hear this, it's, you know, thanks for turning the corner, man. And thanks for making it through all of that to be able to put this documentary together and to write this book and for us to chat about it. And I really hope you guys want to come back to the Hollow Nine Network and talk about actual movies, because I think it'd be kind of cool to get y'all's perspective on how Hollywood kind of, you know, puts their kind of, I don't know, candy coating maybe on some of this, or maybe glorifies some of the things that you guys have been around or exposed to. But is there anything that I didn't ask you guys or that we didn't talk about that when you think about you know, doing the publicity for the book that you really want to get across, that you want to just make sure the audience takes away?
No, you did a great interview. You mentioned our book, Betrayal in Blue, a couple of times. Very good. And, you know, we got the new book coming out. No title yet, but look for it.
That's awesome. Thank you guys for dropping that on the show. That's pretty cool.
Definitely come back and we'll, you know, talk again about movies if you want.
Sweet. That's awesome. Frank,
I would love that. Like, so much.
Yeah, we definitely got to do a Serpico episode. No question about that. And I think comparing it to maybe a couple other movies, which you guys have suggested a list that I'm going to not only make sure I watch, but post on our Facebook page so that all the folks at home can watch too and be on the lookout for when we do that episode. So any other projects you guys got going on besides the next book, or is that going to be the focus for you right now?
That's what I'm doing with Frank. Frank might have 2 or 3 books going on. I don't know. He's a very active guy.
I just released a book called Burned. It's about a true story of a fireman who was the most prolific arsonist of the 20th century.
Oh, wow. An
arsonist / murderer. And he was really something else. I worked with his daughter. And we put a nice book together. She believed her. She prevented. She her testimony kept her dad from getting the death penalty.
Oh wow!
And then 20 years later, she realized he was guilty as hell. The book's called Burned, and it's also available on Amazon. It's, you know, another bad cop story, right? I mean, this guy is really. Amazing psychological profile.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to this sort of, you know, there's a rise in the popularity of the true crime documentaries on Netflix, which is a great place for you guys to go check out the documentary. I think it's just people are becoming maybe more aware that we've got some dark elements walking out there around, As far as just one last question before we go, do you guys feel like, is there any concern with your safety telling stories like this? Is there, I mean, I know you mentioned you have a crazy security system, and obviously you're on the lookout for when people are swinging by your house unannounced to ask you if you could help them with a book. But how did you guys sort of handle, I mean, that element of, I would think that there might be a sort of fear element about some reprisals maybe from some of the stuff that you guys are talking about?
I will say this, I got threatened by one of the guys involved in this after we did it over a tweet, I think.
Oh, wow.
Or something I said on a podcast. And we set him, I mean, Ken set him straight. I kind of set him straight. But other than the random guy driving in front of Ken's house, no. And personally, like from the guy on the outside, I'm not afraid of anything. You know, I'm a journalist. I didn't take part in this, and the people that did, by the way, all of them have served their time. It's over. You know, nobody owes anybody anything.
Right.
There's no bodies buried anywhere that haven't been revealed. And I think that's at least how I live with it. Ken, tell me if I'm wrong.
No, you're absolutely right. There's a no overbearing fear. I mean, there's always a random cycle that might, you know, walk up to do something, but that could, you know, happen to anybody. I don't think it has anything to do with the story or the movie or the book.
Right.
For the most part, people are happy to meet me, and they're, you know, excited to talk to me and hear the stories. You know, they want to hear the live version.
Yep. Thank you for telling them 1,000 times over, man. I tried to come at it from a couple different angles, but I know it probably was the same territory you guys go over a lot, so I appreciate you guys rolling with it and being flexible on that.
No, absolutely. You have a totally different audience from other podcasts we've done, so we're happy to do it.
Very cool, man. Well, thank you guys so much. Everyone, check out the book. I hope it does incredibly for you, and can't wait for the second book. And again, the 7-5, I can't recommend enough as far as documentaries go. I wish I had made it. That's how I felt after I watched it. I was like, fuck, that was such a cool documentary and such an awesome book. Thanks again, guys. We will be talking to them again. For all the rest of you guys, the business is coming up after the music, and we will talk to you next time.
Been listening to the Hollow Nine Network, bringing you the very best in fan-made media. That's the word hollow, the number 9, INE. Now broadcasting from our new home on the web, hollow9.com, where you can find info on all of our awesome programming as well as the team behind the shows. Leave us your feedback, join in the conversation, and be a part of the action. Find the Hollow Nine Network on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. Rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts. Email us at info@hollow9.com or at hollow9podcast@gmail.com. Join in the fun. Hollow 9.